Adrian did his PhD a while ago in Oxford, where he held a position, and then he moved over to the University College Dublin. And his main fields of research are semi-classical gravity and the self-force problem for extreme mass ratio black hole in spirals. And apparently the two problems share similar techniques, and he's going to tell us what these techniques look on global properties of spin functions of black hole spacetime. And maybe he can answer the intriguing question as to why all functions are green functions on St. Patrick's Day.
They have some white and orange functions as well. So thank you very much indeed to Mark and Felix for the invitation to come here and the opportunity to spend a week in this marvelous institute. I apologise that we're running on Irish time where everything runs at least 10 minutes late, but we'll try to catch up a little bit as we go along. So, I thought the title was already long, but if I'd been writing indices, I would change this into local and global properties of green functions in black hole spacetimes and the connection between the two, because that really is, in a sense, what interests me, how we can relate local properties to global properties. So, first, the important things to say. This work represents collaborations with Mark, who you know, Sam, who's Sam Dolan now at Southampton, Anna, who's still a graduate student at UCD, Barry Wardell, who's now at Albert Einstein Institute in Gull, and sponsored by these people. And perhaps one thing I might say about this is I was aware that as Mark was here and I was talking about work we had done together, I had assumed when I was originally putting together this talk that he had spoken about some of the work originally, and so I was actually putting in rather technical slides. I then discovered that he hadn't had that, he hadn't spoken so much about this, and therefore you'll see that there's a very strange mix of some very technical slides thrown in the middle of more general slides, and the technical slides I'll just try and go over fairly quickly. So first, the motivation. So there are actually two motivations. One is quantum, and I'll come back to that in a second, because that was my first involvement with all of this. The second is in classical relativity, and in particular, the problems I'm talking about arise in these extreme mass ratio in spirals. The very interesting thing about these is that they are events which are in the Lisa band are going to be very common. And if we can actually get the funding to fly LISA and our current estimates are correct, then there should be about between 10 and 1,000 events seen per year of these extreme mass ratio systems where you have a central black hole or neutron star, typically of the order of 1,000 to maybe 100 million solar masses, with a small star orbiting around. And as it orbits around, of course, it emits low frequency gravitational radiation. The thing which is of particular interest here, well, one of the problems to numerical relativists and one of the interests to me is the fact that this mass ratio is so extreme that it makes it very difficult to model numerically. I hesitate to put a number on the ratio, but whatever I can say is more like 10 to 1 is
yeah. I mean, you can say 100 to 1 if you're very optimistic, but still, if you're going to be trying to survey the parameter space, it's going to be insane anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So instead, what we're going to talk about, and it's, again, outside post-Newtonian calculations, so instead what I'm going to do is talk about the perturbative approach in which we just do a perturbation of the ratio of the small mass to the larger mass and treat the small mass as a point particle. Obviously, what happens is that the small mass then moves on a geodesic of the total space-time consisting of the smaller black hole and the larger black hole. But at a first approximation, we can neglect the smaller black hole. So at the very lowest order, the particle follows a geodesic. And if we then work to first order in perturbation theory, there's an alteration to that geodesic motion that can be described in terms of a self-force, and it's calculating the self-force that I want to talk about. And I want to talk about one particular method of doing it. It turns out, due to analysis by Mino Sasaki and Ward and Quinn, that you can work out an exact expression for the self-force, but it relates, there are some local terms that are very easy to calculate, but there are some also some non-local terms involving, in schematic form here, an integral of the retarded Green's function over the past, of the entire past world line of the particle. Now, I'll come back and talk about how one can calculate this Green's function. Most approaches actually take a rather global approach to this and immediately go and separate in terms of spherical polar coordinates and go through and break down the problem in that way.
So that's the derivative with respect to the variable, the variable that secures the argument of phi tail.
Yeah, so it's not very well written. Yeah, but yes, it's of x and x prime, and it's of x. It's where the derivative is respect to x prime.
Z. You have z, not x.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I apologize. These were taken from slightly different places. So over here it's x, and everywhere else in the talk it's going to be x. Here it's z. My apologies. You'll also notice. Everywhere else in the talk, I use Roman indices. Here, I use Greek. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have. I pulled this equation in at the very last minute. But what this does tell me is that it's important that I know the full properties of the retarded Green's function. I'll come back to the mode way of viewing this in a moment. But what I'd like to do is to talk about a way that I think gives a much nicer space-time interpretation. When one separates in spherical polar coordinates, one has a very global interpretation. One has to regularize by removing high L modes. And it's very clear, unclear, where the physics is, what is actually causing this self-force, how this integral is actually made up of various contributions coming from the interaction of the particle with its own past. And the approach I'd like to talk about is one that was originally suggested by Alan Wiseman and then developed with Eric Poisson, Warren Anderson. I wrote a paper with Warren and Aina Flanagan back 5 or 6 years ago developing this for gravitation. And the idea is that we consider this integral in two parts. We have a problem when we approach the point, because when we actually have the two points of the Green's function together, obviously we have a singularity. The reason for this epsilon here is that we have to regularize and make sure we handle that singularity appropriately in a distribution theory sense.
So are we to take this literally, or is that hiding some particular prescription about how you handle the singularity?
You can take that literally, or you. What I'm going to do is, because I'm actually going to do a geometrical approach, what this is saying is basically you don't need to include the delta function in the retarded Green's function. It's only the V part of the tail that's important. So that would be a way of talking about it geometrically. If you want to do it in terms of mode sums, yes, you take it literally. In some way, you need to regularize that singularity, because otherwise, although the derivative is here to be strictly correct, you can actually just work out the field to start with, and you can see that you have problems actually doing this integration up to the point where the two field points are the
so
same.
If we take a space-time viewpoint, then we just do that integral. I mean, that's just an integral. It doesn't talk about mode sums. So if we do that, is the integral, leaving aside when epsilon equals zero, is it an integrable?
This is exactly what I'm going to do for you. Okay. I'm actually going to plot in a space-time approach this integrand for you along the whole past world line in a black hole space-time. And hopefully say this shows you, this gives you a geometric interpretation of of what we're trying to do. So what we're going to do is we're actually going to have a slightly different approach to calculating the Green's function nearby. There is classic work due to Hadamard, which is summarized, for example, in Friedlander's book on the wave equation curve space-time, of doing series expansions of the solution of the Green's function when you're within a normal neighborhood, when you're close. Those break down when you no longer have unique geodesics connecting the two points, and one has to come up with a different way of handling the distant past. And the way I'll be talking about is actually in terms of quasi-normal modes, which relate to the black hole structure, and the quasi-normal mode part contribution here can't be valid at small distance, because if one's far away from the black hole, you don't know anything about the black hole until you've had time to go to the black hole and come back again. So this distant part coming from the quasi-normal modes actually can't be good here, and the local part coming from the geometrical series can't be good here. And the question, the million-dollar question, of course, is there actually an overlap region between where the quasi-normal mode sum is good and where the geometrical sum is good?
Did you say this is also leading order in the ratio of the masses?
It is. It is, yeah.
There is an assumption here, right? So the quasi-normal modes, we know it's not a complete phase. So.
Well, at late times, for this, so there are two things. One, the space-time I'm actually going to show you is a model of Schwarzschild space-time in which there is no cut in the Green's function, in which case they do form a complete basis at late times. What we need to do in general is to include that the contribution from the quasi-normal modes and also the contribution from the branch cut, which is what is preventing the quasi-normal modes from being complete in Schwarzschild. So my original motivation, my original research was in how we do renormalization in quantum field theory and curved space-time around black holes. When you're doing that, you're very interested in the short-distance behavior of the Green's function, because you need to subtract that, the ultraviolet divergences, in order to do renormalization. If you naively consider something like the phi-squared or the stress-energy tensor, you have a product of distributions at the same point. It's a priori ill-defined. You need to come up with a good regularization scheme, a renormalization prescription, and then relax the regularization. And it turns out that the methodology that was developed for this problem turns out to be very valuable in the self-force problem. There are, unfortunately, some critical differences. If you're looking at quantum field theory, what you tend to be interested in most is the stress energy, the back reaction. That involves taking two derivatives of the Green's function, and so people develop methods for working out the Green's function and the approximation of its second derivative. By contrast, so that's like saying we're trying to work out cos, but at least we know it's 1 minus half t squared. What we need to do here, apart from getting a pointer that works, So what we need to do here is we actually need to not just go on a parabola. We really need to go as far as we can in order to get down to this region where the quasi-normal modes will come into effect. And you'll see as I go on how far that is. So in all of these cases, we're talking about Green's functions. For the quantum case, it's the Feynman-Green's function. For the self-force, it's the retarded Green's function. This is one of those slides where I was being technical, and so I threw in indices just to say the same formalism will apply to a scalar field, an electromagnetic field with suitable gauge fixing, or gravitational perturbations. But essentially, we just have the wave operator on our curved background space-time. And I think I'm always just going to ignore the deltas and just say, let's have a scalar field. So what we want to do, finding a Green's function, the differential operator, our wave operator acting on G has to be a delta function. This is like the identity operator. So in the marvelous way of theoretical physics, it's very clear that all we have to do is to divide across by D, and we're done. How do we divide across by D? Well, we can use the identity that e to the minus isx or e to the minus sx over integrated from 0 to x is 1 over x, and therefore re-express the 1 over D in terms of an integral over an additional parameter called the proper time of the exponential acting on the delta function. So this has now made significant progress, because rather than having one over a delta, rather than one over a wave operator, we have the wave operator up in an exponential that we can define in terms of the power series, and we just iterate it to our heart's content. And this combination here has various properties. We define it to be the heat kernel K of X and S primed, K of X, X primed, and S, and it's very clear that when S is zero, it just has to give us back the delta function, but also because of the D here, if I operate on this with the wave operator, I just pull down an IS, and I get back what I had before. So that this kernel K satisfies the Schrodinger equation or the heat equation, depending on whether or not you bother putting in the I. Generally, mathematicians don't put in the I, physicists do. So we've reduced the problem to some extent to saying, what on earth does it mean to exponentiate or to have a differential operator acting on the delta function? And this is where we start to come across the split between a global view and a local view. I'm sorry, that's just a simple observation. We really don't need to worry about mass in this theory. The heat kernels for the massive theory and the massless theory are very simply related.
I'm about
to give you the boundary conditions. The boundary conditions come in now. So obviously, I really haven't done very much. I've just given you a very formal structure on how we can think about constructing the Green's function. You now ask exactly the right question. What about the boundary conditions? And here is one way of thinking about boundary conditions and incorporating them into the theory. And that's to take a very global viewpoint. What we do, and this is the standard viewpoint we're taking, elliptic operators and a Stern-Liouville approach, we look for a complete set of eigenfunctions of our wave operator. We normalize them over the space in an appropriate manner. And then Stern-Liouville theory tells us that actually the sum over the eigenvalue indices of the eigenfunctions gives us precisely a representation of the delta function for the problem under consideration. So this is now very nice, because our differential operator was just an exponential of D. These functions U are simply eigenfunctions of D, so we just take our exponential and replace it by the eigenfunction. And in this way, we get a global representation for the heat kernel, and the way we then get the Green's function, we simply have to integrate over S with the appropriate I epsilon, and this is a trivial prescription, and we get a very familiar expression from differential operators of a global expression for the Green's function, which, because we constructed our mode functions to satisfy the various boundary conditions, automatically satisfies the appropriate boundary conditions here. So this is a useful global expression, but unfortunately it doesn't tell us anything about these divergences that we expect when the two points of the Green's function are close together. And that's the second half of the puzzle. So here is our global expression. This could be our sum over Legendre, over spherical harmonics. But how do we know about the singularities? How are we going to renormalize a theory? How are we going to regularize the divergences that we get when the two points are together? Yeah?
Before you come to that, so speaking of the global issues, under what's there, I mean, this is a Lorentzian metric. It's not a Riemannian one. So
yeah.
What does one know about this Ostrom loop theory?
Okay. The spacetimes I'll be considering are static spacetimes, in which case Bob Wald and way back showed this essentially goes through without change. But actually,
globally static. Not like, so Stripes would not count?
The exterior region of structure would count, which is what I'm concerned with. But in a sense, we always are writing down expressions like this for the Green's function in quantum field theory in curved space, just by forming a complete set, satisfying our appropriate boundary conditions at the various points. But this was more a motivational side talking about the global aspects. So when we construct the Green's function globally, the retarded Green's function globally, we will be taking an approach very much like this, where we separate out in spherical harmonics and in time, and then which is where it relates to the Euclidean approach. And then you have the radial function, and the radial function just gives you a one-dimensional Green's function where you put an ingoing condition at the horizon and an upgoing condition at infinity.
Yeah, I'm just trapping on this a little bit. We're coping with some similar question, but in the case of De Sitter, for example, so
okay.
That's not globally static.
Well,
do you know whether it would work in that? Is it guaranteed to work in that?
Maybe I'll show you some pictures later, because actually one of the spacetimes we'll be doing is actually very much like De Sitter. And it's actually an Nariai spacetime, which does have a Penrose diagram that you could not distinguish from De Sitter, and you do have the static region in that. Although the global De Sitter invariant Green's function is the thermalized version of that static Green's function. But here, I will be assuming always that I'm sort of in the exterior region, and that everything I do is motivated by classical. But I'd be very happy to talk to you about that afterwards. Let me move very quickly through the next few slides, because I don't want to only cover this. And as I said, this is actually more technical. But this actually is the other side of the picture. Suppose I want to understand the singularity structure of the Green's function. I can actually do it in terms of constructing a representation of the Green's function, which is precisely the standard flat space Green's function written in the tangent space with the yi's being normal coordinates. So this is just saying I can pick any point x, I can cover a neighborhood nearby with normal coordinates ya in terms of describing an initial tangent vector and the distance to go along. If you go through and then apply the same procedure. I need to be able to express my differential operator here in an appropriate form in terms of the normal coordinates. I most certainly am not going to go through the details, but you can just do an expansion of the wave operator in terms of those normal coordinates. You have to be careful, of course, because you're doing an exponentiation, and therefore you have products that don't commute, but by a suitable use of appropriate Campbell-Baker-Hausdorff or Sassenhaus-like formulae, you can just re-express this. And what you find is that the heat kernel K here just has the form of a power series in, well, I beg your pardon, the heat kernel can be expressed as a differential operator acting on the heat kernel for flat space-time written in normal coordinates. So this is just the heat kernel in flat space-time written in normal coordinates. This is a simple and calculable differential operator that if you have the patience, you can go through and apply. And what it tells you is that the Green's function in a curved space-time has the structure of precisely the heat kernel for flat space times a Taylor series in IS where the coefficients are simply functions of the normal coordinates.
So you now have to do the integral over S, right?
And now have to do the integral over S, yeah. I should say that none of this is me. This is all. This is the way you get the DeWitt series. And I would not recommend that you calculate these coefficients AS in this way, but I do think thinking of it as being the exponential of the differential operator acting on the tangent space delta function is a very natural way of understanding where this structure comes from. The problem of normal coordinates is that I have to choose one base point and then take the geodesics from there. That's a very undemocratic procedure. So let me try and restore a bit of democracy by calling on the Irish relativist J.L. Singh, who defined a function which is simply constructed by taking advantage of the fact that the geodesic equation can be derived from an action of the form GAB dxA by dTOR dxA by B dot by dTOR if TOR is proper time, or indeed more generally if TOR is an affine parameter related to proper time, so that we can actually construct something which is independent of the choice of affine parameter. If we consider this object, it now depends on two points, x and x prime, the first and final part of the point of the Green's function. And if we do the variation, then we find that L is a constant of the motion, which tells us that if we use arc length, our object S is just 1/2 tor squared. So this object S is 1/2 the square of the geodesic distance between x and x primed, or equivalently in normal coordinates, this is the expression we had before, 1/2 e tray b y a y b. Excuse me. Most importantly, if I consider the variations of the endpoints, then ds by dxa can just be related to dl by dxa dot, which is just the derivative, it's the tangent vector to the geodesic at the end x primed. And if I differentiate with respect to s, I get the tangent vector to the geodesic at x with a minus sign. So that's the picture I have here. Here's my geodesic from x to x primed. Sigma a is the tangent vector along here, and sigma a is the tangent vector, again, both pointing outwards. Moreover, this object, very quickly, you can show that it satisfies the property that its length is such that GAB SA SB is equal to 2S. And this indeed enables you to completely define the Singwell function S together with the initial condition that if you have a very small separation between the two points, then obviously the geodesic distance is just GAB DXA DXB. Conventionally, we use sigma for this, not S. But it's very nice because it enables us to write a much more democratic version of the ansatz that we wrote down before, where now, instead of using e to a b, y a, y b, we use this sing world function sigma. And instead of writing this just as a function of y a, we write it as a symmetric function of x and x primed. This is totally local. How does it know what the boundary conditions are locally? How does it know, for example, if we're doing the Casimir effect? Well, the answer is this is only an asymptotic expansion. There are terms in here that are not captured, that they're not analytic at S equals zero. Just very brief aside, this is actually related to the important mathematics of come on here, the shape of a drum. If you actually go back to my expression for the global representation of K, and set x to x primed and integrate over x, then you just get e to the minus I lambda I s. And if you go to my de Witt expression and do the same thing, put x to x primed, integrate over, you find an asymptotic expression for this zeta-like function of the distribution of eigenvalues. And this is why these quantities are very, very important to mathematicians. And this is a fundamental difference, for mathematicians, they only care about the coincidence limit. Indeed, the coincidence limit integrated. For quantum physicists, they only cared about second derivatives. We care about everything. The answer, incidentally, is that you can't hear the shape of a drum. These two drums sound the same, according to Wikipedia, although this is actually cheating because this is all about differential geometry. These don't have smooth boundaries, and if you actually go to smooth boundaries, then under suitable conditions, if you have convex shapes, you can indeed go a long way towards hearing the shape of a drum. So these are geometrical objects related to the spectrum of the operator. The way you do calculate these de Witt coefficients is just demand that it satisfies the wave equation. You then equate the powers of S to zero, and you end up with a sequence of recursion relations started off by the first one, A0, which is the constant, which is equal to 1 when the two points are together. It turns out that this one can be solved exactly in terms of a very important second derivative of the world function. Before I do that, let me just say, if we have a geodesic, obviously we can do parallel transport along the geodesic. And what I can do is that I can introduce a little bi vector. This is something which behaves as a vector at both x primed and at x, such that the result of parallel transporting the vector TA to x primed is ga prime b tb. And this can be defined by the fact that it obviously has to not change under parallel transport, and that when the two points are together, it's just the identity matrix because I haven't done anything. Okay, this is one of those technical slides that obviously I can't go through, but I can just give you a spirit of. What we can do is we can consider a very important object, which is this world function differentiated once at x and once at x primed. And what we can do with just a few simple manipulations from the fundamental relationship that 2 sigma is sigma a, or equivalently sigma d prime to sigma is a symmetric function, we can actually show that it satisfies the differential equation that we needed a0 to satisfy. So this is indeed a0 itself. The thing about this is it represents a Jacobian between a transformation, between a coordinate representation of an area around x in terms of x and x primed, and in terms of start off at x and go a certain distance along that direction. So locally, I can either give this coordinate and this coordinate, or I can give this coordinate and say, go 30 centimeters in that direction, and I'll have 2 equivalent coordinate representations. The Jacobian between those two is precisely this object, or I beg your pardon, the Jacobian matrix is this. The determinant of the Jacobian is the determinant of that and is called the Van Vleck-Moret determinant. And it is central to all of the theory that we're talking about. Again, this is going to be a 30-second transparency. In talking about the classical wave equation, Hadamard and Friedlander use a slightly different representation in terms of u and over sigma minus plus epsilon and v times log epsilon. This actually is totally equivalent to the DeWitt representation. If I take the Green's function written in this form and express these coefficients UAB as being formal series in this quantity sigma, the geodesic separation, put that into the wave equation and ask that we satisfy the wave equation, then we get a series of recursion relations for the URs and for the VRs. I think I need the hockey stick. The U0 turns out to be just precisely the delta of the half we found before. So what we can do is we can just say, okay, if I take that out, I have delta to the half over sigma plus something which is then regular. So we tend to represent that as being W, and then V is exactly a linear combination of the A's we had before. So, again, technical slide, no intention of going through it. The important thing to take out of this is simply that knowing the AKs is equivalent to knowing the VRs, and that if I know them for the massless theory, I can write them down immediately for the massive theory. So what I'd like to do is, if I'm doing a local representation of V, what I want to do is to do the Taylor series. I want to take my cars and I want to do the Taylor series to high order to see what I can glean about the local behavior. I need to do it in a covariant way, and fortunately this object sigma is just the very natural object to do Taylor series in. If you're in flat space, it is of course just e tray b delta xa delta xb, differentiate it, then sigma a is delta xa, and your Taylor series would just be coefficients of delta xa. So we can just write a covariant form of this where we have the delta xa being played by the role of delta xa being played by sigma. At this point, you don't need me to tell you that this leads to horrid algebra. I think I've given you enough horrid algebra to give you the spirit that this is really disgusting. What the traditional approach to this is to take this expression, differentiate it, commute derivatives, introducing Riemanns, and this is what you end up with. This is me back 20 years ago with Bruce Allen and Antonio Fallaci doing a calculation for gravitons in Schwarzschild space-time. It's just a real mess that goes on forever and ever. The reason people have got away with it is that when you're talking about quantum field theory, you only need the second derivative. If we want much more, then this simply is a nightmare of a method. And for example, to work out AR, you need to take 2R plus S derivatives and commute them around. So to go to three or four orders is just a nightmare. So this is just a non-starter. Fortunately, it turns out that there's a much more elegant representation where this can be written in terms of transport equations for these operators. And one of the great advantages of this is that you can actually express this in a highly algorithmic form. The fundamental problem is to know this van Vleck-Moret determinant to very high order. It turns out that if you write down the Taylor series for it and insert it into this transport equation, then you're able to get a recursion relation which relates the lower coefficients, or sorry, the next coefficient to the lower coefficients anchored by an explicit knowledge of the first two coefficients. Unfortunately, my computer doesn't want to let you see.
What was that? Can you remind us what delta was?
Delta?
Capital delta.
Capital delta. This is the matrix whose determinant is the van Vleck-Moret determinant.
So just the double gradient of the same world function.
Yep, correct. And this is just to say, this then becomes totally trivial. We can do this with computer algebra. It's simply a question of writing a little bit of Mathematica code. So in this way, we can now actually calculate V0 out to 20 orders. So this is now not 1 minus 1 over 2 x squared. This is out to, I've only given it here, out to 20 delta x, order x delta x to the 20. In fact, if you restrict it and say, we're not talking about general space-time, we're not talking about vacuum space-time, we're talking about, for example, Schwarzschild space-time, then it's very straightforward to take this out to order 60. And this is exactly the sort of thing we've done. And you can calculate the DeWitt coefficients. This one takes you about a minute. This one by hand. This one takes you about an hour. This one was calculated by Denjo O'Connor, who I think is visiting a moment, about 20 years ago. It's himself and two collaborators. It took them a very long time. It's a major event when it came out. The reason you have to have two collaborators if you're doing these calculations, as I know with Bruce Allen and Antonio Fallaci, is that you meet at the beginning of the day, you go away and say, we're going to calculate this term. 4 hours later, you come back and you compare your results. And if all three agree, great. If two agree, and you're the third, you're in trouble.
Ginger's actually in Dublin
at the moment. Yeah, I know. I saw him. We just met in the lunchroom very briefly. So in this way, we can actually generate these series to very high orders. And I say the point of this is it enables us not just to approximate our cos, our v, our Green's function by a low-order Taylor series. We can actually do extremely high-order Taylor series. Now, it may scare you here that we're talking about things like 3 million terms in this, but in fact, by the time you go to an explicit space-time, this is very simply derived. I should say here that one problem is that this code will generate an expression, but it might, for example, have a divergence of a Ricci tensor. Obviously, you should re-express that in terms of a gradient of a Ricci scalar, and that's what the canonical means. So it's known that these are the number of canonical terms. So we have actually converted these expressions into this. We've converted this expression into this. We're currently converting this expression into canonical form. So far, it's taken 288 days of computer time, but 1 second of our time. Just press the button and wait. So that was to say, these can look horrendous, but in fact, in principle, in practice, when you come to use them in a particular space-time, they're really quite manageable expressions. So here is V4 just calculated. I could have gone further. For example, A6, which has never been calculated before, we are 80% of the way through. It would fit on half a transparency in a vacuum space-time, which is where you want to really interested in this. Okay. Sorry, I can't finish quickly, but this is actually where I wanted to get to quickly. So my problem is that those local expressions now break down. So they break down because I no longer have a unique geodesic joining the two points, and my delta to the half blows up. You can see here's a representation of a black hole. Here is geodesics coming both ways around the black hole and crossing, and we have no longer a unique description. You can see that here. This is actually calculating the Van Vleck-Moret determinant using the Taylor series. This is where the geodesics would cross, and we know this must be infinite. You'll actually see that we've got halfway to the boundary of this, halfway to the area of the normal edge of the normal neighborhood. This is the radius of convergence of our Taylor series estimated by the root test or the ratio test. So we're now extending out a very long way. We'd like to get all the way here. Unfortunately, we know that, as I say, we're looking at something which is diverging. We're not doing a Taylor series of cos. We're doing a Taylor series of 1 over 1 minus x. And when we do that, we're going to see singularities. The natural way of handling that is through Pardé approximants. And if we just take our series and do Pardé approximants, we can actually get an expression which is valid. Here is our Taylor series expression. Here is the Pardé approximant to it going all the way out to the edge of the normal neighborhood. So we can actually, by using these power series, now get out all the way to the edge of the normal neighborhood using local methods. And if we don't want to do it covariantly, we can just do it in a specific space-time. We can just integrate away. So here, for example, is a plot of the Green's function on the light cone. The tail of the Green's function reduces to V0. And this is actually a plot of the Green's function on the light cone in Schwarzschild space-time.
I thought that the C kernel was only asymptotic, so it doesn't actually converge. But you're talking about a Taylor series.
This converges, yes. Yeah, this actually. So this is an analytic space-time. So, in analytic space-time, you're in better shape. This is, let's say, this is Schwarzschild.
What does it mean? This is an analytic space-time? Do you mean the function is analytically known?
Oh no! If you have a C infinity metric, then indeed the heat kernel is only asymptotic. But if you say it's analytic, then you can go further. So it's often said, but in fact you just go and you calculate it. And this could be used for initial data, for example, to calculate.
Analytic means that if you take the Taylor expansion of the metric somewhere that it's converges to the metric error.
That it has a non-zero radius of convergence. So unlike e to the minus 1 over s squared, which you can differentiate to your heart's content, but has a zero radius convergence, this has a proper Taylor
series. So if the metric has that property everywhere, then the heat kernel expansion does very well?
in regions where it has that property, the heat kernel expansion does very well, yes. Unless you go and do something nasty like putting in boundaries or whatever. Yeah. So I'm sorry, this is where I wanted to get to, and let me talk now about the other half of this, which is, okay, we've got out to the edge of the, we've done the quasi-local part, we've got out to the edge of the normal neighborhood. Is that enough, or are there contributions from the distant past from that region outside the normal neighborhood? Well, the answer is there are, they're very important, and let me just very quickly tell you how we're going to get them. So I'm going to take a spherically symmetric space-time, and I'm going to do my mode function decomposition. This was the decomposition I was telling you about earlier in terms of spherical harmonics. And I have a simple radial equation. What I would like to do is to take this real omega and convert this into a contour integral. So this comes back to your point. So when we're going across here and we go close the contour for t greater than t primed, we get convergence along the curved infinity, which gives us our delta function on the light cone. We then also get holes in the complex plane, which correspond to zeros of the Wronskian between solutions that are purely ingoing at the horizon and purely outgoing at infinity. Those are the quasi-normal mode frequencies, and they give a contribution that we can pick up, and there's also a cut contribution. What I'm going to talk about today, for about 1-2 minutes, is just the contribution from the poles, and leave to a later day their contribution from the cut. It's very easy to work out. It's just given in terms of derivatives of these coefficients with respect to frequency and the corresponding radial functions at that complex frequency. You can see here that, or from my diagram, omega only has, the quasi-normal modes only exist in the lower half plane, so they have negative imaginary frequency, negative imaginary part, so this is actually a negative coefficient, so these will only converge when we have t minus t primed minus r star primed positive, in other words, when we have a sufficiently large separation. I think I'm going to skip this. This is a way that we can actually get extremely good approximations to the quasi-normal mode frequencies for high L. Obviously, if I am going to construct the Green's function through this way, I have a double sum here over N and over L. N actually is a damping number, so the higher N's are very rapidly damped, so they're not so relevant. But the higher L's are actually very important. And indeed, what we'll see is that the higher L's actually contribute to non-local singularities in the Green's function. To do that, I need to work out the high L quasi-normal modes and the corresponding high L quasi-normal mode wave functions. And I can do that by making a transformation to my wave function which respects the existence of the critical orbit in the space-time. The fact there's a critical orbit in the space-time means that, which is just the unstable photon orbit, means that I can make a change of variable that naturally incorporates the quasi-normal mode boundary conditions, which is that because the Wronskian vanishes, I have a solution which is purely ingoing at the horizon and purely outgoing at infinity. That's automatically incorporated in this. This goes to minus 1 at infinity and to plus 1 at plus infinity, and so the V's just have to be well-behaved.
Yeah. I guess these boundary conditions correspond to the retarded, what do you mean for the retarded groups,
The quasi-normal modes tend to be defined independent of the particular Green's function. It just is, but it's motivated by certainly the study of the retarded Green's function.
Yeah, I mean you can divide other quasi-normal modes with different boundary.
Yeah, you're right. But yeah, these are for the retarded Green's function. Having done that, we get a difference equation for V. And this naturally emits a WKB-like expansion that's, again, very easy to implement, and we can get incredibly accurate estimates for not only here the quasi-normal mode frequencies, but also the excitation factors, that is, the residues at the poles. This is a high L expansion, and yet even for L equals 2, we have agreement to four decimal places of the very best methods. Just to show you some real calculations without the branch cut, this is the Poiseuille-Taylor potential, which arises as the potential in the Narrier space-time, which has a metric very similar to Schwarzschild, and indeed an exterior structure in the inner diamond, which is quite similar to Schwarzschild. And I say this diagram actually is identical to that in De Sitter space. It has the advantage that it doesn't have the branch cut. The reason for that is that the potential decays exponentially at both ends. In Schwarzschild, you get the branch cut because although it decays exponentially towards the horizon, it has a parallel tail out towards infinity. We can actually do now an explicit calculation of the sums and the residues and which correspond to the excitation factors. And this, we can see that this is divergent unless there is time for the particle to actually experience the potential around the black hole. But it's convergent once there is time for light to go in from the particle to the peak of the potential and back again. And what happens is let me come on to that in a moment. First, I said the critical question was, can we match the quasi-local to the quasi-normal mode? Here is the quasi-local. That's the Taylor series. That's the Pardee approximant. These blue dots here are the calculation from the quasi-normal modes. And you can see that we have very good agreement over a broad range of tors. We've actually proved that by doing a calculation of the self-force on a static particle in this space-time. The blue curve is an exact calculation in the sense of numerical calculation from integrals of the Legendre functions making up the Green's function. The dots are from the quasi-normal mode calculation. Okay, this is a picture I really wanted to show you and to finish on. The quasi-normal mode sum is normally extremely well behaved and you can just calculate it. What can happen though is you can get coherent phases. You can get coherent phases in this sum. You can show that those coherent phases arise precisely when a null geodesic has gone around the black hole and come back. At those times, you no longer have a smooth representation for the quasi-normal mode sum, or for V, you actually have singularities. So here, this is the singularity corresponding to once around the black hole, I beg your pardon, skimming around the black hole, this has done one complete circuit, you get a second singularity. Three times around, you get a third singularity. Moreover, you can actually express the structure here in very beautiful form. Here, you have a divergence, which is a 1 over mod t, or a 1 over t divergence. Here, you have a delta function. You then go on to a flipped 1 over t divergence, another delta function corresponding to the next loop around, and so on and so forth. And this is what we were, a version of this is what we were integrating to get the self force. So this is really the global structure of the tail term of the Green's function related to the GOD6. I've gone over, so let me just show you pictures. These same techniques can be used to generate data for singular field calculations. This is what you have to subtract from the field in order to regularize it. We can get, by doing these high order Taylor series, very smooth representations of the regular field, and which then greatly improves their convergence in L and reduces the numerical overhead. The cut is a really important contribution. This is a picture of delta G for two points. I can't remember, Mark, you can probably remember where they are. Two different radial points. The red is for spin 0. The blue is for spin 2, which has an algebraically special frequency omega is minus 4i, giving rise to this additional structure. So the contribution of this to that picture we have for Narii is our current challenge. And other challenges, let me just go through very, very quickly. Everybody uses this Hadamard representation. It actually is an ansatz, though, and one can have the very unfortunate situation that all of the VKs are non-zero, but V is equal to zero. In de Sitter space, that happens. So we actually have developed a new approach, which is guaranteed to be minimal. So if the coefficients vanish, the function vanishes. What happens when we try to evolve these numerically outside the number? Sorry?
Conversely, is it? If the function vanishes, the coefficients vanish.
Yes.
You said the opposite. You said if the coefficients vanish, the function vanishes.
I beg your pardon. Yes. If the function vanishes, the coefficients vanish. I beg your pardon. Can we evolve these outside? How can we relate these generally, not just in a special space-time, to the contribution outside the normal neighborhood? Can we actually talk about a Van Vleck Meret determinant along each GOD6 and work out the total Green's function in that way? And finally, I put this one in specifically for Mark, who is a great fan of this, these critical orbits and quasi-normal modes now seem to be very important in understanding radiation reaction. Are they also important in understanding the Hawking effect? And note that the existence of this critical orbit is actually very critical in the quantum theory in terms of whether black hole mining is efficient or not.
What is black hole mining?
Getting the radiation out from Hawking evaporation would be very fast if there wasn't a potential barrier outside the black hole. So most of the Hawking radiation actually just gets bounced straight back in and gets kept inside. Bill Unruh and Bob Wald came up with a paper way back where basically you stick a straw through the horizon, the radiation just goes out to infinity. But it's related to these various issues. of transmission and reflection. And at that, let me just wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
So you showed us that integral with the epsilon regularization.
Yep.
But I guess you just pointed out that there can be singularities not just at the coincidence limit, but because of these orbits.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So what is the regularization there?
Well, what we have actually done here, so this is V. Or G, so V, G within. So what we've actually done here, obviously, is this was generated by computer. This is not a delta function.
Right.
It is a sum up to some L max. This is a Gaussian centered at this point where, as L max increases, it's exactly the standard Gaussian representation of the delta function.
Uh-huh.
And obviously,
so you're saying your regularization is to cut it off at some L max and take the limit as much L?
So we plot it for a large number of L's.
Or if the statement that the Green's function is just a well-defined distribution and you just do the integral right across.
Yeah, but this is actually the distribution itself. So this hasn't been smoothed against anything. This really is. I'm plotting here something which is distributional, but obviously the representation of the delta function here is a smooth version, which is a Gaussian.
So perhaps what's confusing is that at the start there was a regularization for t equals to t prime when the two points x prime come in here. So there is a, if you follow mode sum technique, you would have to regularize that mode sum in order to cater for that singularity at coincidence points. But you let this our physical singularities for the Green functions that you don't need to regularize.
I see. So they're okay. Even though the singularities are still integrable in the world.
Absolutely.
Sense, and
one of the interesting questions to approach is the contribution of these singularities to the cell force. The cell force is an integration of the Green function all throughout the natural world.
Yeah.
And if you just include those singularities, does it give a good approximation?
Or just those alone?
Yeah. Because, for example, you might. Yeah. So what level of cancellations are you going to get between here and here, and between here and here, or is everything? I think, Mark, you looked at this, didn't you, after we...
I think we definitely didn't do any further than that.
If the two points, the two spatial points, x and x prime, are both far from the black hole, then the higher order singularities are, you can neglect them, is that right? No, that's correct.
Is that far away?
No, wherever you are,
they'll still be there.
They will still be there.
But the amplitude.
We don't want to be too far away, because obviously what we're interested in is in a black hole which is spiraling into the thing. So this is, I can't remember, it's around 10 m.
Pretty
this
close.
Calculation was performed.
Well, ultimately, the object will be coming from really far out, right? So it will be going all the way to very long scales.
Yeah. I have a graph somewhere of this at different radii. I can't remember working out the strength of the delta functions at these various points and calculating this function of radius.
They get more and more stronger and stronger as points get closer and closer to the horizon. Or as they get close, maybe as you get closer and closer to the light ring, probably. That's probably it. Because then you would.
So certainly as the nudges go around in time, so the more orbits they go around the Van Vleck term, the diminishes, I would say, exponentially. Certainly diminishes faster, so it's exponentially in my real space time. But your viewpoint is a little different, and it's an interesting one to tackle. So just to emphasize this, I don't know if people probably know, but just to emphasize. So there's a propagation of singularity theorems by Wald and Kay and so on, saying that the Green function should diverge whenever the two points x and x prime are connected by a null geodesic. And these are what the singularities are, this point fixed x, and any of these x prime points are met by a null geodesic, so they're physical in that sense.
What was the story with that coincidence? How does the integrand actually behave?
By doing it this way, it's quite straightforward, because what you know in the Hadamard form, if I go back, I don't know what this computer's doing. If I go back to my expression for the retarded Green's function, it consisted of two terms. One was a delta function multiplied by the delta to the half, and the other was the V, which is the tail, which is sort of expressing backscattering by the geometry and giving you propagation within the light cone.
Yeah.
In the geometrical approach, one of the great joys is that the only role of that epsilon is to say that the delta to the half over sigma doesn't contribute.
But so the other one is what? It's not a 1 over, is it 1 over, what's its dependence on?
It's a theta, it's V.
V is a theta.
It's a switch on.
I see.
So it's the imaginary part of the log of sigma plus I epsilon that you're seeing in the retarded Green's function. So in the Feynman-Green's function, you see that log, and that's important in the trace anomaly. But in the retarded Green's function, it's purely a theta, and the role of the epsilon is just to get rid of that term. It's a much more complicated one for, I think. it's a much more complicated problem in the mode sum. So this is one of the advantages of this approach.
Okay, so I think, thank you very much. So I think Adrian will be around until all day tomorrow as well, if anybody wants to ask any questions. And we'll be going for St. Patrick's Day kind this evening, if anybody wants to join us. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Is there a
PubMed? No, there's no.